You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The following program is a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Showman.
Hi, this is Roy Showman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the radio show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. If you've been with us for a while, you know that one of my favorite things to do on the show is to have guests, particularly if the guests are other Jews, who Jewish converts, so to speak, or grateful entrants of Jews into the Catholic Church. And a few weeks ago, I had a friend of mine, Dr. Rhonda Chervin, on to speak about her, to give her witness testimony and tell about her conversion. And she has agreed to come on again today to talk about a subject that should be very dear to the hearts of all human beings, and particularly all Christians, and that is love. And in fact, Dr. Chervin, who is a philosopher and a philosophy professor, I'll let her introduce herself perhaps, has recently written yet another book, which I think is in makes her total count in the 60s now of books that she's published, on love. In fact, the book is called The Way of Love. And I invited her on to talk about love and maybe even what love has to do with Christianity and one's relationship to God. So with that introduction, welcome, Rhonda.
Oh, I'm very happy to be with you here today. And the book was not written by me in terms of the relationship between Judaism and Christianity. However, there are probably plenty of people out there like me with a Jewish background but brought up atheistic and brought up with a very skewed idea of love. So even though if we had had a religious Jewish background, our idea of what love was would have been much closer to the Christian ideal of love. But in my case, the way we thought of love was only romantic love. You know, romantic love was like the cat's meow, so to speak. That was the thing that we desired the most, was exciting, thrilling, romantic love. And we had very little sense. We had experience of other kinds of love, but we certainly didn't think that love in the sense that Christians call it agapic love, that is, love that consists in self-giving sacrificially very often to help other people, that certainly didn't rate high at all. In fact, we had the very peculiar notion that people who were good, they were only good because they were too stupid to do something better, which would be to do exciting, intellectual, creative things, see? So that was a very skewed idea of love. And actually, my parents didn't live up to their ideals. They actually were very loving in many ways that didn't have anything to do with romantic love to us kids. And however, coming from that background, I was astounded at all the many meanings of love that I found when I became a Christian, a Christian Catholic at the age of 21, under the auspices of philosophy, specifically the philosophy of Dietrich and Alice von Hildebrandt. So what I would like to do is talk a little bit more about themes in my book. And first of all, the way that book came to be, it's called The Way of Love, The Battle for Inner Transformation. And it's actually a compilation of four different books that I wrote over the years about love, but put into a very user-friendly format in a book that I published in such a way that you could get this 400-page book for $10. See? So I thought that way I could perpetuate the book. My students would buy it for classes. I teach at Holy Apostles College and Seminary in Cromwell, Connecticut, and I'm always teaching courses in the philosophy of love. both on campus to seminarians and to lay students and MA students, but I also teach it to distance learning students. We have a terrific distance learning program. And most of the people in the classes are people who are teachers, either high school teachers or parish teachers, parish ministry teachers to young people and so on. So they love this book because it's very, as you will see, it's very concrete. So
the book is sort of almost like a workbook, right, with exercises.
Yes, yes. So anyone could read this book and follow the way of love and grow in love through these different themes. So the book is divided into these four main little book chapters, which are What is Love?, Overcoming Obstacles to Love, Making Loving Moral Decisions, and then a thing called The Way of Love Step by Step, which is a 100-day, I call it a 100-day spiritual marathon to be a better person. And so it's a terrific thing for Lent, of course, but for anyone at any time. And it has different themes, and then day by day, exercises you could do that would improve your, you could improve your way of loving enormously. To just take one of the most elementary ones is called the challenge of thanksgiving in this marathon. And just spending a whole week all day long thanking God for everything can change you from, at least for that week, can change you from being a miserable curmudgeon to being a very grateful, happy person. Because if you really stop to thank God for everything, not just beauty of nature, say, or the people you love in your life, but also for the light that's in your room or for the toilet paper, for instance, you could greatly expand your sense of gratitude if you really think that way and pray that way. So those are the type of things that are in the book. And I thought we could start with the first chapter of What is Love, which is about how do you define love anyway? So how would you define love, Roy?
Oh, boy, I'm out of my depth.
Just a few words. Not definitive.
Well, being married to a philosopher, I think the term I just learned is sui generis or something like that. I can only identify it. I can't define it. It clearly has to do with wanting the good of the other. It clearly has to do with finding the other, precious and dear. There's clearly the element of goodwill and of wanting the best for the other. But I can't do a good job.
No, that's pretty good. All right, I'm going to give you two different definitions of love. One is Thomas Aquinas, and Thomas Aquinas defines love in a very earthy way. He says, love is the appetite for the good. So when you love something, you think it's good and you desire it because it's good. Now, it doesn't have to be really good. If you think it's good, even if it's bad. So if you think that this is ice cream and it's only a poster of ice cream, you feel the desire for it because you think it's ice cream. So even if you're wrong, what's attracting you is something that you think is good. But here's a definition that's much more grandiose from Dietrich von Hildebrand, the philosopher, the famous German but American teaching in America, Dietrich von Hildebrand, the husband of Alice von Hildebrand, who you people often see on TV, on Eternal Word Network TV. So Dietrich von Hildebrand defines love as a response to the unique preciousness of another. So think about that for a minute. A response to the unique preciousness of another. So when you think of people as obstacle courses, you obviously don't love them, right? So you see someone as just either an obstacle course or a contact. That's not love. So that person is either interesting or not interesting to you simply because either whether you can use them or not use them. So they're like a thing. Okay. But when you respond to the unique preciousness of another, you consider this person so valuable, or this thing, it doesn't have to be a person, if another could be a painting or music or a pet, but you're seeing this as uniquely precious. Okay. Now, besides defining love, we have a thing that's very surprising, which I took out of C.S. Lewis's book called For Love. C.S. Lewis is the famous thinker, Christian apologist, probably the most famous Christian apologist of the 20th century. And most people know him because he wrote The Chronicles of Narnia. So people know that movie. But he wrote a book called The Four Loves, and he distinguishes four different kinds of love. And the one, when you ask people what is love, the one that most comes to people's minds is what's called caring, serving love. And that would be this thing where you want to help people because you see they're in need. And you want to do that even if you don't know them. So you hear about some poverty-stricken person and you send money. So you want to help people in small ways, in big ways. That's the one that all of us identify as Christian love. But Lewis thought there were very other types of love which are very important as well, including friendship love and affectionate love and passionate love. So let's look at, for a moment, at affectionate love. And this is found in families, but also for pets or for people we see in the workplace, the parish, or the gym. It comes from familiarity. And at first, this seems like a kind of trivial thing. So you feel a certain familiarity with people. Let me give you an interesting example. In the workplace, you could have 10 years ago, you could be working somewhere and there was an individual who you didn't like at all. You never exchanged important things, anything dear to your heart. You didn't like them. 10 years later, you meet them in the airport and you're so glad to see them. Hi, Buster. Remember, we worked side by side at this aircraft company 20 years ago. You know, suddenly you're very happy to see them. Why? Because they're familiar to you. So even people you don't like, you could become familiar with in such a way that you feel a certain affection for them. And so by affectionate love, he means, I mean, it certainly includes people you like to touch, but not in the sense of lust, but rather that you like to touch because you feel this affection for them. And it's very typical of family love in spite of all the dysfunctions that can exist in a family. So, you know, people think, oh, yeah, affection, love, that's nice. I was had an abused childhood. I was emotionally abused. I was sexually abused, all these horrible things. In spite of all of that, there could still be a lot of affection in that family. See? Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. And one way we would put it is bonding. You can be bonded to people even if you don't have an exalted sense of love for them in the sense of, I have this deep love for this person. In fact, you'd rather not see the person often. And yet you still have this familial bond. And then you have friendship love. And C.S. Lewis points out, you could live without friends. You can't live without family because you'd never have been born. I mean, you have to have somebody who gave birth to you, right? Okay, and you can't live without God because you wouldn't exist without God. But friendship love is a very beautiful type of love involving shared values. And C.S. Lewis says these values, the deeper the values, the deeper the friendship. On the other hand, a friendship can be built just on we both like to play this game, or we're both Boston Red Sox fans. When we meet at work, we talk about the games. You could have a friendship based on that common value. And then you have passionate love. And passionate love we usually associate with romance. Lewis insists there's two very different kinds of passionate love. One of them, which he calls eros, is a sense of someone or something being wonderfully beautiful, and you want to possess this beautiful being in some way. Like, okay, I saw that beautiful house. I gotta have it. I must have that house. That house is perfect. Or the ocean is so beautiful, I've got to live near the ocean. So that would be a passionate love that wouldn't have to do with lust. He says falling in love is based on the sense of the beauty of the other person, like this unique preciousness thing that von Hildebrand was talking about. On the other hand, you could have lust for someone who you don't think is beautiful at all and have no desire to possess. You just want to use them for sexual purposes, which is completely different. I mean, it's an attraction and there's a passion to it, but it's a completely different emotion that's involved there.
Well, it doesn't qualify as love since you're not wishing the good of the other.
No, not according to C.S. Lewis. See, if you say it doesn't qualify as love, then you're saying the only definition of love is caring for the good of the other, that he considers a passionate. Right. Yeah, of course, it's not love in the sense of pure love or Christian love. Absolutely not. But there is a passion to it. So it depends how you define love, you know, what you're willing to put there.
I might have misunderstood, but I thought you were describing something which is really pure lust to use the other person.
That still has an element of, I know what you're getting at. Certainly, it's not love in the sense of Christian love. Now, see, this is one of the points that C.S. Lewis makes, is that all these loves, they all can become distorted unless you have them in the context of love of God and God's love for you. Each of these loves, in his book, Four Loves, he describes how each of these loves can become distorted. So let me give you some examples. So obviously, Eros love can become distorted when it becomes just the passion of lust, because then you're just using someone, you don't even care what their name is. It's so distant. Okay. So that passionate love has to be baptized in Christ, in Christian theology, but in any religious ethics or philosophy, that has to be surrounded by that feeling of sexual attraction, has to be surrounded by real love for the person in their unique preciousness as created by God. It can't be just floating out there, because otherwise you could just use some sort of a machine to satisfy sexual desires. Okay. And Eros love, that falling in love, that can be distorted when it becomes an idol. So typically, if you think of the great tragedies of love, like Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, say, or something like that, you have people who will have this feeling, if I can't have the beloved, I'm going to either kill my rival or kill myself. So then it becomes an idol, because only God can make us happy. And thinking that if I can't have so-and-so, I can never be happy, is making something into an idol. So that passion love has to be, again, surrounded or encased, if you will, in the love of God, so that you see that God's love counts most, and then God has given you this gift of the love for this other person. But it's not as if this other person is going to be a substitute for God. Now, of course, this is very confusing, because there are many people who are religious to some extent, they would say, God is the most important being in reality, and religion is very important to me. I would never give it up. And yet at the same time, it's not the center of their lives. So they don't know God well enough to choose God over a person who's driving them crazy, who they're so attracted to, they feel they'll die if they can't have this person. See? Mm-hmm. Right?
Let me, I hate to do this, but let me interrupt for two things. One is to take a short break, as we usually do, around this point in the program. But also to suggest that when we come back, I know that one of the things that I most appreciated about your book was its practical aspects. And I know that you were married for a long time and have a lot to say about the impediments to love within a marriage and ways to overcome those impediments to love within a marriage. So what I would like to suggest is maybe when we come back from the break to transition to helping our listeners, perhaps, if they, you know, with issues or problems that married people face in doing a proper job of loving their spouse. Would that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
So with that, this is Roy Shoman, your host. The show is Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria. Our guest today is the prolific author and philosopher, Dr. Rhonda Chervin, professor at Holy Apostles College and Seminary, also a Jewish convert and a longtime friend. And we'll continue our conversation when we come back from the break.
Knocks me down again. I'm reminded of the wrong that I have said and done, and that devil just won't let me forget. In this life, I know.
You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hello, welcome back. You're listening to Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria. I'm the host, Roy Shoman, and today we've been speaking with another Jewish Catholic, Jewish entrant into the Catholic Church, Dr. Rhonda Chervin, who is a philosopher and philosophy professor. And she has recently written a book, The Way of Love, and we're talking about love and how to grow in love and the relationship that love has with being both human and being Christian. Before we get into the substance, maybe I should ask you to let our listeners know how they can get a copy of the book if they're interested in what we're talking about today.
Okay, if you just Google the book title this way, you could just go to Amazon. It's published by Amazon. So if you go to Amazon and then go into search on Amazon, just put in The Way of Love, Rhonda Chervin. Rhonda has no H. It's just R-O-N-D-A. And my last name, Chervin, is C-H-E-R, V for Victor, I-N for Nancy. Because there's another book by the same name, The Way of Love, that Amazon sells. You've got to put in my name, and it ought to come up, and it's only $10 or even less.
Great. And by the way, if our listeners are interested, Rhonda has written scores of books, and she has a website, rhondachervin.com, or what?
Right. Just put in, just Google my name.
Just Google Rhonda Chervin, R-O-N-D-A, last name Chervin, C-H-E-R-V-I-N. And you can find her website and find out about the other books she's written, and also through her website, link to Charlie Rich, who we've spoken about previously on the show, and some of his writings. He was a very pious Hasidic Jew who became a very pious Catholic contemplative for the rest of his life and has very beautiful spiritual writings. And you can find some of them also through Rhonda's website. So, okay, let's go back to The Way of Love and how we can grow in love and how married people might be able to overcome some of the obstacles that they find in growing in love with their spouses.
Well, probably one of the most salient obstacles to love in marriage is irritability versus acceptance. So I have a whole section in my book called Overcoming Obstacles to Love. And just to give you a list of a few, I have moodiness and anxiety versus steadiness, indifference versus friendly, zealous service, irritability versus acceptance, boredom versus interest, anger versus peace, being balanced versus addictive, self-confident versus envious, warm versus cold, forgiving versus unforgiving. So some of these are even more important, like forgiveness is more important than acceptance, even in a certain way. But this, in marriage, the habit of irritability is certainly huge. And the way I like to think of this is this, that if I look at the day and I think, I am the heroine of the drama of life. You, my husband and my kids, you're secondary characters. You should enhance my role. You should say the things that will make me have a happy day. You should do the things that will make me have a happy day. Well, obviously, if that's my plan, I'm going to be irritated all day long, right?
Yeah.
So basically, we cannot be so aware that that's what we're doing, because we could have some of these positive features of these other loves. For instance, in friendship love, you have a lot of delight. And in familial love, in family love, you can have a lot of delight. So you could think, well, of course I love so-and-so because I delight in them. At the same time, if I'm irritated all the time, then that's not loving in the sense of this caring love at all. So if you're trying to do, to exhibit Christ's love, you can't be, Christ's love was not centered on everybody just exists to build up my image or to make me have a good day, right? He's trying to help people. So even if the framework of the marriage and family life is self-giving, involves a lot of sacrifices. If on a daily basis, moment by moment, I'm irritable all the time, then that's because I'm not accepting, I'm basically not accepting the terms of life on this earth before heaven. I'm wishing everything could be terrific. I'm blaming everyone around me that it's not terrific. So let's just take a very simple thing like neatness versus messiness. So very often in a marriage, you have one spouse who's very neat and the other spouse who's messy or cluttered, you know, has a lot of clutter around. So if I'm the heroine of the drama and let's say I'm the neat person, then since I'm a neat person, why shouldn't I be happy by forcing everybody around me to be as neat as I am so that I can have peace and order in this house after all, see? Okay, but meanwhile, the other person is saying, I wanted to have a happy life with my spouse, but this idiot considers neatness more important than love. Like, she's so hung up on, you know, we call this OCD now. She's so OCD about neatness that she's busy straightening out the forks in the in the little container for the cutlery instead of smiling at the kids. See? So that kind of thing. So you both have things that you want from the other that they're not inclined to give you, and then you could be irritable all day. So what would be the remedy for that would be, first of all, would be compromise, which you would think that all, I mean, in all marriage prep thing, preparation workshops, et cetera, or any kind of marriage counseling, they always talk about compromise. So my husband and I, we had a very wonderful compromise, finally, but it took me years and years, for years, you know, you could substitute irritability for compromise. So instead of trying to figure this out, I didn't like certain pictures that he loved. And so I would get very annoyed that I had to see big pictures in the living room every day that I didn't like. So finally we talked about this and we decided, why don't we take one room of the house and make this into your study, dear? And in the study, put these pictures that you love that I don't like, and I'm never going to clean your study. I'm never going to even go in there. You can keep it as messy as you want, see? And it worked, actually. He was very, very happy in that study, and it worked, and I wasn't complaining every single day in my head, if not with words. You know, you can be irritable in your head. I wasn't thinking every day, why does he like that Picasso picture, which I think is ugly, abstract, and demonic? You know, let him enjoy his Picasso picture someplace else. See, so there are many things like this. There's a very funny joke about this couple who gets married and they're ecstatic because they love each other so much. And 2 months later, they're at the marriage counselor and he's saying, it drives me nuts the way she rolls up the toothpaste. She rolls it all the way up and then some gushes out. You know, why can't she roll it from the bottom? Why can't she just punch it in the middle instead of rolling it all the way up? And the counselor looks at the two of them and says, what's your income? And this is way back. This is like 50,000 between the two of them. Don't you think with $50,000 a year that you could buy two tubes of toothpaste and not have this problem? So a lot of problems in life are like this, where there's the most obvious compromise, unless we are so selfish that we don't want to compromise at all, because what we want is that the spouse would be this slave, actually, emotionally, who would just do what I want because I like it this way.
Yeah. Or basically, as you're talking, what becomes clear is you said it earlier when you said, essentially, you know, is this really a play about you, and everybody else is supposed to be a supporting actor without a kind of selfhood or autonomy of their own, and are there just to fill the parts in your play? Or is it about death to self and negating yourself for the benefit of those around you?
If not going so far as death to self, it could at least be we're co-stars in the drama.
Yeah.
But I'm the star and you're the secondary character, right?
I've been married only a few years now, and frankly, I wonder what I ever brought to confession before I was married. since marriage is such an excellent environment to see all of the times during the course of the day when we do put ourselves first or don't think in terms of the selfhood of the other, but think only in terms of how things affect us.
And an aspect of this that I think is very, very important is the framework. Even if I say creeds and go to church, if I really think this earth is all we have, then I have to be happy now or never. And anyone who's in my way is destroying my life. See? So if you really think, though, that you have eternity, a whole eternity, which is like umpteen million times longer than a lifetime, that you have all this time to be happy with God, and that this time on life has a different purpose, that the purpose of life on earth is not to be happy, but is to grow in love so that you'll have space in your heart when you get to heaven with other people. But we don't judge. If we would judge our day on how loving have we been that day, but we don't. We judge the day on how much did I get done. See, now how much did I get done in terms of my agenda, so that I felt efficient and successful, which is pride. See? So it takes enormous, all the great saints and contemplatives knew that it takes enormous concentration to even be aware that we have attitudes that are a great block to being loving. But, of course, the spouse can tell you immediately. I have this little joke I say to people, not just your spouse, but if you asked everyone you knew what was wrong with you in terms of your character, how is it that everyone would say the same thing and you would be surprised? So just to give a personal example, I was thinking the whole family, I have a lot of problems with anger. So I've been in anger management for years, and I wrote a book called Taming the Lion Within, 5 Steps from Anger to Peace. Anyway, so I've been working on anger all my life. And so I asked the family one Lent, okay, what should I give up for Lent? Sure that they would say anger. And instead, everyone said, you're such a puddle glum. Everything anyone says, let's do this. You always have the 5 reasons why it's going to fail. And you're a drag. You know? And I'd never think of that. But everybody agreed that I did this perpetually, all day long. So we can be victimizing people by an attitude, which is, you know, and we don't even know that we're doing that. See, so especially in marriage, you know, I've challenged married couples over the years to do this, but I don't know if anyone ever did. But I've always thought it would be nice if a couple would sit down and say, what is one tiny little thing I could do differently which would make your life happier? Say, a woman might say, I just wish when we're having breakfast together, of course nowadays people's lives are so disparate that having breakfast together is unusual, but let's say, when we're having breakfast together, I wish you wouldn't read the newspaper, but just, we could just chat pleasantly while we eat breakfast. So I felt it wasn't like I'm looking at this paper, this whole newspaper in front of your face between you and me. You know, so that's not a huge sacrifice, right? I mean, it might be annoying or it might take a while to get used to, but it's not a huge sacrifice. And say, the other one would say, he might say to her, I wish that when we're enjoying something together, say a favorite TV program, that you wouldn't take the phone so that we could have this time together to relax and have fun. Instead, you get on the phone and talk to your best friend and go through all her problems and do a counseling session with her problems. And meanwhile, then you come back and say, oh, what happened to these characters? See, all kinds of stuff like that. So there could be very small ways in which people could sacrifice something for each other to give a feeling of things could get better between us. It doesn't have to be what Henry Thoreau called lives of quiet desperation, you know, where everything is just, I resign myself to your horrible traits because we're committed in the sacrament of marriage, but, you know, you're not hoping for anything good. So that's a... Those are some thoughts.
Well, that's excellent. Although I do want to, maybe in part because this is a Catholic religious show, but I do want to just hit once more a little bit that I find confession absolutely invaluable for seeing my love with my spouse grow and for seeing the harmony in the marriage grow because there's always something. I mean, there's always, whether it's irritability or impatience or flashes of anger or not paying attention to the other. There's always something one can bring to confession, and there really is grace associated with it. And there's also awareness, and, one grows in awareness of these relatively small faults, perhaps, in relationship to the relationship, but those small faults or impediments to the relationship are like, you know, sand in gears, and they can be pretty small, but they can really keep the gears from meshing. So especially now that we're entering into Lent, it's always an excellent idea, of course, to go to confession. But I think in my life, my short married life so far, confession has been the single most valuable thing for growing in the marriage.
Oh, yes. Now, let's talk about that. I think that's terrific. And I think it starts with the fact you can't improve in areas that you're in denial exist. You know, so someone might say, well, you know, I'm not going to go to confession. Let's say messiness. I'm not going to go to confession to talk about how my husband's a neatness freak and he's driving me crazy. I mean, why would I go to confession about such a trivial matter? So the thing is seeing that within a love relationship, that if there's no give and take, if each one says, I am what I am, put up with me, that you're not going to have a lot of joy out of that. So just the fact that one would admit that this is something that is unloving to my spouse. And I doubt if there would be any confessor who would say, don't bother to confess that. That doesn't matter. You know, See, so it's not the, you're right, it's not the degree of the thing, like the huge sins against marriage, but these little ones are very important. And of course, the point is that we can think we can do it all by willpower, but it just doesn't work. We need grace. So even taking the time to pray, to be, for instance, in the car coming home from diverse activities that people are in, it would be neat if in the car, the family or the kids, whoever's with the kids, would say a prayer. We want to pray to have a beautiful, joyful evening together. Instead of, well, get out of the car, you know. You know, we have this rough way of talking to each other in family life that's it's certainly not going to make us more like marriage, like Mary and Joseph doing that.
No. No. Well, I'm afraid that we've come to the end of the time that we have. So I'm going to have to say goodbye and say goodbye to our listeners. I don't know if there's anything that you quickly want to close with, Rhonda.
Oh, yes. Let me say a prayer for this. Dear Jesus, you want us to be holy, and holiness would be having nothing but love in our hearts. And you know our souls and hearts through and through, so you know all the little pockets of anger, discouragement, boredom, all these ways in which we don't have love in our hearts. So we lift our hearts up to your sacred heart, dear Jesus, and put your heart into ours. Immaculate Heart of Mary, come into our hearts. And help us to rejoice in the people you have given us in marriage, in friendship, in the workplace. And help us to appreciate them and to really see this unique preciousness of each other. So that all that love that we have accumulated on earth may be like a rope pulling us up to heavenly love and happiness one day. Amen.
Amen. Beautiful. So thank you. Thank you very much. I want to thank our listeners for joining us today, and join us again next week on Salvation is from the Jews. Bye for now.
Bye.
You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The program you just heard was a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Showman.